The Turing test uses humans as a baseline to evaluate the existence of intelligence in a machine. What if we thought about machines as the baseline to examine when something about being human is lost? So if human beings behave like a machine, indistinguishable from a machine, with respect to some capability that's essential, like your ability to reason, your ability to relate to others, to socialize, or your ability to determine your own beliefs or preferences in the manner of free will. If you're no different than a machine, I'm observing you in some particular context, and I can't tell you from a machine as far as those capabilities go, then something seems like it might have been lost. Like you're behaving like an automaton with respect to something that matters. And if that happens, at least a yellow flag ought to go up. What is it about the techno-social environment that they're in that's leading the person to behave in a manner that's machine-like with respect to this kind of thinking or this kind of relating or this kind of thing that we think is essential to human flourishing?
I'm Misha Da Vinci. This is the Grift Podcast. Conversations distilling the smartest ideas, latest research, and best steps to get you ready for the very different future we're already living in. I believe technology holds the solution to many of our human challenges, and innovation is vital for the survival of our species. But digital technology and artificial intelligence are dominated by a handful of trillion-dollar companies, and their agendas have nothing to do with our well-being. If you were born after the year 2000, you probably wouldn't notice. But humans are being re-engineered, quietly reprogrammed to fit into a world of machines. We're being trained to think less, disconnect from our core human values, and do what's fastest, easiest, and most convenient. Click that agree button, align with the algorithm, abandon your humanity. Some say the defining feature of the early 21st century will not be the rise of smart machines, but the dumbing down of humanity. It's a global techno-social engineering operation run by the tech giants. My guest today has researched and written extensively about the techno-social engineering of humans. In this episode, we will discuss how techno-social engineering works, the human-focused Turing test, how user interface design decisions shape what we want or think we want, why engineering a world for happiness is a bad idea, how to know if you're becoming a machine, and more. This episode will change everything you think you know about yourself. Let's dive in and get ready for the future.
Brett Frischman, thank you so much for coming on and chatting with me today. I am so excited to talk with you, and I'll tell you why in a second.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I came across your writing a couple of years ago when I was thinking about the impact of technology on humans. I was thinking, we think about it in such limited ways, but there must be other effects or impacts that this technology is having on us. And what is that? And in the future, and I think that we're already in the future, but in the future, would we even be human? So I was thinking about this and I was like, I have to look and find what the experts have been saying about this. And I came across your piece, which included the human-focused Turing test. And the paper was Human-Focused Turing Tests, a Framework for Judging, Nudging, and Techno-Social Engineering of Human Beings. And I was like, yes, this is so great. Somebody's not only thought about this, but they devised a whole test to test it. So I want you to tell us about that in a little bit. Before we get there, let me just tell people who you are. Okay, so I'm going to read your bio, and so they know what the hell we're talking about. So Brett Frischman is the Charles Widger Endowed University Professor in Law, Business, and Economics at Villanova University, an affiliated scholar of the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law, and a trustee of the Nexus Center for Internet and Society at Politecnico di Torino. He teaches courses in intellectual property, internet law, and technology policy. Brett is a prolific author whose articles have appeared in numerous leading academic journals. He's published important books on the relationships between infrastructural resources, governance, commons, and spillovers. And a bunch of books, I'm not going to read them, the one I will mention is, along with Evan Selinger, he's the author of Reengineering Humanity, and this book examines techno-social engineering of humans, various creep phenomena, boilerplate nudge and surveillance creep, which I think we both discuss, and modern techno-driven Taylorism, which is, I don't know, Taylorism, which I don't know what that is, but we'll talk about that. And the book develops a series of human-focused Turing tests to identify and evaluate when humans behave like machines, which is what this podcast episode is all about.
Becoming more like machines. A bunch of jargon-filled stuff that we're going to talk about.
Right. Okay. Brett received his BA in astrophysics. I thought that was really cool. From Columbia, an MS in Earth Resources Engineering from Columbia, and a JD from Georgia University Law Center. After clerking for the Honorable Fred I. Parker of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, this guy's all over the place, folks. He's astrophysics. He's Earth Resources Engineering, and now he's at law. And practicing at Wilmer Cutland Pickering in D.C., joined Loyola University Chicago Law Faculty in 2002. Now he's at Villanova, and yeah. Looks like a real human, though. So, Brett, what do you have to say for yourself? What was this journey? I mean, how on earth? Astrophysics? Like, start right there.
Well, thanks for the wonderful introduction. astrophysics was incredible. I loved studying it. When I was a kid, I wanted to design cities in space. That was always what I wanted to do. And so I went to school and studied astrophysics, and I studied engineering. Even when I was an undergraduate, I also studied engineering and did math. I was a math minor and loved all of that. It was fantastic. And so it took a lot of turns in life. You know, I went to engineering school focused on really sort of civil and environmental engineering. And there's this particular degree, this Earth Resources Engineering program. Studied that, got really interested in sort of large-scale systems, things like climate change, and got motivated to go, in part, to go to law school to be maybe to get involved in decision-making or academic thinking that sort of looked at the intersection of science and policy. And I still am interested in my younger brother actually is a climate change expert. I mean, I still maintain an interest, occasionally write about environmental stuff as well. But I got drawn into science and technology, internet tech policy while I was in law school, and sort of, so for many people, it's like about faces in like completely crazy directions. To me, it's sort of a meandering path, but it all sort of is building up and going in this, you know, it all kind of builds on each other in interesting ways.
Well, they all inform each other and position you to think in at a higher level. So when we're all in our little silos of study or thought or whatever, we're just thinking within the parameters or limitations of that. And then, but when you can see beyond that and see how all of these different things intersect and interconnect, then you really bring added value to the world. And so thank you.
I mean, it's interesting you put it that way. Like the way I see the book we're going to talk about mostly, I think, the Reengineering Humanity book, I sometimes will describe it as like, I see a lot, there's a lot of little puzzle pieces, each one of which is super interesting, and each one of which is what occupies the attention of an advocacy group or of an academic or of a bunch of people who are riled up about something. And they're really interesting in their own right. But when you start to see the different puzzle pieces and put them together and sort of in a particular formation, you start to see a bigger picture, a systemic problem, an intergenerational systemic problem akin to climate change, which we can talk about the connection if you want in a bit. But it's sort of the Reengineering Humanity book is about putting up together a bunch of disparate puzzle pieces that no one previously had really put together in a way to sort of show that, you know, the wearable technologies and social media stuff and things, smart home technologies, and, you know, a lot of the different technologies that we are we're becoming accustomed to, and they're raising seemingly different issues, are actually connected in an underlying sort of systemic way. And so you need to think more broadly about those systems. And so Reengineering Humanity is just putting those pieces together so you can reveal something you might otherwise not appreciate.
Absolutely. Right. So before we go forward, though, I want to go even further back and tell us how, like, a little bit about you, your backstory. Even prior to going to Columbia, how did you even get there as a kid? What were you thinking about? What fascinated you? Because I think it's really important for listeners to sort of, I like listeners to understand the human journey of the guests, because you're all experts, but you started out just as a person. So tell us a little bit about that. Like, where did you start out and what were you interested in as a child and how did you evolve into you?
Well, it's interesting because I've done a lot of podcasts. This is not a question I've ever gotten, and I appreciate that.
I always aim to really take the conversation in a different place because, I mean, honestly, people could just go find the other podcast where you talked about the same topic. Why repeat it? So I really hope to ask different questions and elicit a different conversation. So
you've already done it. I come from a big family, so that's one thing that probably has had a huge influence on who I am and how I think and how I look at things. So I have 7 siblings, 6 brothers and 1 sister. I grew up in upstate New York, right on like Ontario initially, in Rochester, New York. My family, you know, we are all get along pretty well, though not perfectly. And we have all the sort of standard sets of issues you find in a family. Always pretty driven in academically, personally. I've always sort of enjoyed school, enjoyed learning. I won't name names. Not all of my family members would say the same thing, I suppose. Some would. And we just have a variety of different people in our family, which sort of affected how I grew up. Pretty sporty, I guess. I mean, there was always basketball and soccer and volleyball, like different sports I played. I'm 50 now, and I still play soccer competitively 4 times a week. I'm pretty active in that sense, and kind of always have been. One of the important things is I think really hard while I'm working and I'm doing, and this is true when I was a kid, but it's sort of growing up, like I always work really hard at school and sort of enjoy that process, but I needed to shut down. So sports for me has always been a way to socialize and a way to sort of not be thinking, at least not be thinking about what, you know, academic stuff, but you're just thinking about the game you're playing or thinking about what you're doing, but in a very different way. I always found that to be an important thing. I've always been kind of pretty much that. I don't know what else in terms of my background.
You got it. Okay. We established that you're human.
I'm a human person. That's true.
You passed the human. Yeah, you passed the human test. So, Brett, what, as you, through your lenses, from your vantage point, when you look at the world, the future, everything we face as human beings, as a planet, what bothers you, concerns you, or scares you, just in very general terms?
Well, there's a lot of things. I mean, but the stuff that sort of motivates me, I guess, work-wise, or the thing that, I worry about quite a bit is sort of short-termism, like an inability to see beyond our own noses. Distrust in expertise or distrust in sort of others. There's a set of like symptomatic problems, I think, with sort of some of the logics that sort of drive sort of both politics and culture. And they're very hard to fight and they're not easy fixes. There's another thing like related to all that is sort of a sort of wishful thinking about the power of sort of panacea-like solutions. Like where everyone's in a search for like the one thing that's going to fix everything, but there's not one thing that's going to fix everything. I don't know. The book we're going to talk about is very sort of, in a sense, some have described it as pessimistic and dystopian. I don't think it's pessimistic and dystopian at all. I think it's kind of in the middle. But some people describe it that way, usually because they haven't read it and they've just read like the blurb or they've read like, you know, the back cover or something, or they looked at the picture on the front. There's a lot of folks that would describe it that way. And it is more pessimistic about the path we are on. And in that sense, and we'll maybe talk about this, you know, part of that has to do with some of these logics, these sort of commitments that we have. I will say that the first book I wrote about infrastructure and the value of shared resources was very optimistic about open shared platforms and infrastructures. And some people often say, well, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future? And I think that I'm usually the answer is yes, both in different ways. I mean, the political climate in the United States is something that scares the hell out of me and how it sort of is affecting the rest of the world and back and forth, the dynamic effects. That stuff is worrisome. And there's plenty of things along those lines we could potentially go into, I guess.
But what excites you? What's super something that you're like, yay, there's a lot of stuff that's challenging across the board, but what's exciting?
I mean, it's the funny thing is this is like the flip side, the same coin, right? So a lot of the things that are scary and troubling, we've built systems that allow us to have immediate, near costless access to millions and millions of strangers. And we that we democratize speech and access to knowledge. And that's something I'm optimistic about. Like, that's a great thing in a sense. But on the other hand, it hasn't necessarily led to a smarter and more capable population. And so it's very positive that we've built this world. Yeah. In other ways, it's very scary that we've built this world because it's not inevitable that democratization of all these things leads to the benefits that people imagine. At the same time, that's what you can kind of be excited about. I mean, we've built incredibly powerful systems. What excites me is when we have, good human social interactions, good things happen. All the negativity about the state of the U.S. and our politics and stuff, there are lots of really good people throughout the country who mean well on both sides and however many sides you want to pick and look for, there's great people involved. Yeah. So when you actually get to real people and understand people, you see that there's lots of good in humanity as much as I might worry about the path we're on in certain ways, we're not all the way at the end of the path that I worry about. We're sort of still living in a pretty good world.
Don't you think it's maybe because this digital technological revolution, it's still happening. It's not in a static place. It hasn't happened and this is what it is now. It's evolving. And part of the evolution of it is thinkers like you come in and say, hey guys, we're going, this seems to be going in that direction. We need to adjust our course and course correct here, course correct there, or we need to build in guardrails here, or these are some issues. And so let's fix it. So it's all part of the process of us evolving together as humanity. And the pushback that critics of technology have, which is the moment you say anything that even critiques tech, they're like, oh my God, you can't say that. Innovation, how dare you? And this is part of the innovation, is having smart people critique and help you to improve.
There's a short essay in the Scientific American I wrote a few years ago about there's nothing wrong with being a Luddite. And someone was basically, accusing me of being a Luddite at some conference. I was giving a talk or something, and they were like, you're a Luddite. And I said, well, first of all, I'm not a Luddite, but there's nothing wrong with being a Luddite if you actually understand what Luddites were about and what they meant. But the point is that in modern discourse, it's the quick labeling. It's like, Jonathan Haidt has this book, and there's a lot of controversy about the book about the social, whether social media is, or smartphones. The evidence shows that they are a major cause of the mental health crisis among teenagers, right? And there's a debate. Fine, there's a scientific debate. I think if you read in social media or a lot of the newspapers or blogs coverage of this debate, it's incredibly superficial. And it's either one side saying, he's incredibly right, everything he says is correct, we've got a disastrous situation, or it's people saying, oh, this is just another moral panic. So like the response to critics is consistently either you're a Luddite or you're perpetuating a moral panic. But there's moral panicking about moral panicking on the other side. And so, almost like you can't really take seriously the minute you see someone calling someone else a Luddite, or the minute you see someone saying, oh, this is just a moral panic, it's hard to take the person seriously. And so one of the struggles is finding who to take seriously. And so, yeah.
And that, then that's part of the sort of algorithmic dumbing down of our global society as a whole, because of this whole, okay, we're all connected now, and now we can engineer that. But so we'll get into that. So I first came across your work, as I said, in your paper called Human Focused Turing Tests. And I want to talk a little bit about that before we get into the re-engineering book. Can you tell us what, if people don't know, what the Turing test is, how it came about, and then what is your human focused Turing test that you devised?
There's an interesting origin story for my idea, like the reverse Turing test or the human focused Turing test, which I can tell you in a second. I think you asked me first, though, to explain the Turing test. So I can do that first if you want. Alan Turing in the 1950s wrote a paper where he basically asked the question, can machines think? Right. And then he sort of immediately pivots away from that question of can machines think, because it's an intractable, it's too hard a question to really, you're going to get stuck trying to define what it means to think and what it means, what a machine is. So rather than getting stuck in like endless definitional circles and fighting about definitions, he proposed an observational test. We said, look, one way to think about about figuring out whether a machine could think would be to apply this kind of test, which ultimately gets called a Turing test. So what a Turing test does is you basically take a machine, or really a software, code running on a machine. Like think about just text software, a chatbot. If an observer, you take a bunch of people and you talk a bunch of bots that are running on different computers. And they're participants in a game. And the judge of the game, or the observer in the Turing test, basically sits behind a screen or is in a different room than all the participants, some of which are just people, sitting and typing things in a terminal, and some of which are software programs running on a machine. And if the observer mistakenly observes, he's asking questions, it's just conversational text, and they can't see each other, because obviously you could see the person, it's a person, you see the bot, it's a bot. But if you can't see, it's all just conversation by text. And if the software bot or the machine was mistakenly, and the judge is basically saying, determining whether someone's a person or a machine. And if they mistook a machine for a human because of its performance in a conversation, well then, hey, that machine is intelligent, or it's at least, it raises a flag that you could then evaluate, but at least plausibly you could think like that machine should be given attributed intelligence, because that's kind of how we attribute intelligence to each other, right? I don't really know what's going on inside your head. We're talking right now over the internet. For all I know, you're just a bot running on a machine. But when we talk to each other and how we talk to each other, we basically attribute a mind and intelligence to each other based on how we interact, often through conversation. And so the same kind of rationale sort of is motivating this idea of a Turing test. If a machine could mistakenly trick a human being into thinking it was a machine, well, then maybe we should think it's intelligent. Now, this kind of test, then for many, they made predictions about how long it would take, and there's different ways you run it. And they've run this at something called the Loebner competition. They sort of run these, they've run Turing tests over time. But in reality, no machine has really passed the Turing test. Every once in a while, you hear that that's happened, in the sense that some observer, some judge mistook a machine or a software program or chatbot to be a human. They said, oh, it's a human, and it turned out not to be. But once you sort of looked at the situation and looked at the questions that they asked and sort of looked at the scenario, everyone quickly figured out like it was just a mistake. Like there was some sort of mistake in the way that they ran the test, or no, it was just a bunch of stupid questions that were asked. The observer was kind of, not actually running the test according to certain rules or something. But no machine really demonstrated the kind of intelligence that Turing had sort of posited one would suspect based on this test. So anyway, what this does is the Turing test leads to sort of motivates a bunch of research and a way of thinking about AI. So it's a lot of people sort of think, okay, sort of AI grew out of this moment in time when Turing and other people were sort of thinking about this kind of question. All right, so I hope that's a useful enough, basic, quick intro.
Yeah.
We could spend an entire semester talking about this.
I'm getting that. So tell us about your reverse Turing test.
It's basically asked the opposite question. So in the Turing test, human beings serve as a baseline, right? Like you're evaluating machines, but you need something to sort of figure out, like judge them against. And so humans become a baseline against which to judge machines, right?
The machines.
In a reverse Turing test, I don't care at all about whether machines are intelligent. I care about whether humans are engineered to be unintelligent or something else. Like we could talk about what those other things might be, but I want to use machines as a baseline to evaluate human behavior. And we might just start with intelligence. So if a human being behaves in a way that's indistinguishable from a machine,
and
they're mistaken to be a machine, like I think you're actually a machine because of how we're interacting. And in the book, we tell the story of there's sort of an older story. I think it was the New York Times, about a New York Times author was sort of interacting with a help professional, you know, on a helpline, and he, you know, mistook a worker. To be a machine. It's, oh, this is just a chatbot. You're just an AI. But ultimately it wasn't. It was just outsourced to, I think it was in India, a call center. And he says, oh, well, it was really just because the person working the call center was, English was their second language. That's probably why I made this mistake. Evan Selinger is my co-author in this book, by the way. Evan and I sort of suggest, well, that's one explanation. Another explanation is that people working in call centers are so heavily scripted that they're in an environment subject to incredible pressures, and what they're supposed to say and how they interact is so scripted they don't think for themselves. And that so the responses that the author was getting was from a human who was in an environment, techno-socially engineered environment, that affected how they behaved in a manner that made them machine-like. And so they would have.
So
go ahead.
So no, exactly. I think when I started thinking about this whole question, that's what sort of triggered it. This sort of feeling, a sort of gut feeling and intuition that engaging with technology on the internet, engaging with the internet consistently was modifying or changing my behavior, how I functioned, how I thought. I was like, is this changing me? Am I being maneuvered? You call it nudging. Am I changing? Am I becoming less human because I have to fit into this techno world? And then, of course, then the Amazon warehouses that was coming up and people were talking about that. I was thinking, wait a minute here, there's a problem that nobody is thinking about. And then you had addressed it beautifully. So, okay, tell us why it's important to even think about this, maybe techno-social engineering is happening. Maybe we need to evaluate our behavior. Are we becoming more like machines? Why is that important? Why should we consider that?
Well, what motivated me initially to sort of think about this idea of a reverse Turing test. We weren't actually thinking about Turing tests at all. Like, Turing was out of mind. We're kind of thinking initially about how various technologies or things we've built, techno-social, we keep using the words techno-social engineering. What we mean by techno-social engineering are sort of tools, things that we build and use that affect who we are, right? So it's techno-social in the sense that it's technologies and social institutions. And it's engineering. Instead of engineering, you could use make, use, construct, nudge. There's other words that are more or less synonyms for engineering in this context, but you're using techno-social engineering, and then it's of humans. So we care about how the tools we build are engineering who we are and how we behave. The idea was, you know, I think we worried about these various technologies being, quote, dehumanizing, right? Like, oh my gosh, this technology is dehumanizing. And the more we researched and thought about sort of how do we prove it, you realize that, you know, many people for millennia, like centuries and centuries and centuries have made claims that this or that technology dehumanizes, right? This is like, you know, right. I don't know, Socrates worrying about the invention of writing, worried about it being dehumanizing because of impact or the ability to sort of recall oral tradition and things, right? So people forever have said technology dehumanizes. So what's new, Frischmann, Selinger, others, about now saying that like the internet or digital network technology dehumanizes? How would you know? So it's difficult to know when a line's crossed. Like, how do we know when technology is diminishing or somehow impacting our humanity, when it's gone too far? Like, how would we even detect when it's happening? How would we evaluate any changes that we're suggesting are happening? In order to do that at all in a meaningful way without just being dismissed as Luddites or as, you know, fearmongers or as, I forgot the other word, you know, moral panic perpetuators or something, like, you have to have some kind of baseline for humanity, right? So if I'm less human, if something's dehumanizing, it's somehow impacting my humanity, well, how do I measure or evaluate a deviation from some standard baseline you have in mind? Now, there's lots of baselines you could pick. There's lots of things to argue about. What Evan and I eventually sort of move towards is an idea of capabilities essential for human flourishing. So we say it's sort of, there's a couple things. Like, to be human is one thing. We could think biologically about like how evolutionary biology can define, like, as a species, what it means to be Homo sapien, like what it means to be a human. We have certain capabilities or certain things we do that are a result of biology. And there's some special powers that human beings have that no other species we know of have, right? We can imagine things that don't exist. We can communicate with each other in person, across time, across space, because of the technologies, but across generations, about the things we imagine that don't exist. No other species we know of does that, as far as we know. They might, and we just don't know it. But no species we know of imagines things that don't exist, communicates about those things that don't exist, and can communicate across generations about those things that don't exist. These are the capabilities that allow us to build laws that last across generations. These are the things that allow us to build technologies, ideals and commitments and human rights treaties and sort of, you know, all of the big picture foundations of civilization are like products of some of the basic capabilities that we as human beings have evolved to have, right? That's what it means to be human, is that we have some of these special powers, in a sense. What matters, but there's a difference between what it means to be human and what matters about being human, or what we think of as our humanity. So what matters about being human is how we exercise these special powers, right? So things like the capability to have free will, right? Like free will, whether you believe in it or not, we can frame it in terms of autonomy or rationality. We can reframe it in terms of different capabilities, but we just take that one as an example. The belief that you can author your own life, or that you have some degree of freedom to determine how you live your life and who you are, as opposed to it all being predetermined by God or fate or something behind, you know, antecedent conditions, right? That belief is something that we've socially constructed over centuries, and we maintain. It's like the foundation of lots of modern laws and civilization, about ideas about responsibility and ethics. But it exists because it's constructed and maintained, because we can imagine that it exists and we can maintain it together. It's one of those things. It's a capability essential to human flourishing that we think matters. So the idea about, like, if a technology is dehumanizing, we want to have a baseline to evaluate whether something's been lost or diminished, is when we turned this idea of capabilities essential to human flourishing. And so I was actually out at the Erie Canal, like sitting outside with Evan, and we were sort of talking about this idea. And we just sort of, it's one of those like random sparks in a conversation you sometimes have. And it just sort of said, well, we need a baseline. You need something that we know humans have some capability and when it's been diminished. And we kind of thought about, like, we were thinking, like, what are these capabilities? Well, reason, the ability to reason, and common sense, the ability to sociality, to relate to each other. And we said, well, these are things that humans have that machines don't. And then this kind of spark happened where we're like, well, you know, the Turing test uses humans as a baseline to evaluate the existence of intelligence in a machine. What if we thought about machines as the baseline to examine when something about being human is lost? So if human beings behave like a machine, indistinguishable from a machine, with respect to some capability that's essential, like your ability to reason, your ability to relate to others, to socialize, or your ability to sort of determine your own beliefs or preferences in the manner of free will. If you're no different than a machine, like I'm observing you in some particular context, and I can't tell you from a machine as far as those capabilities go, then something seems like it might have been lost. Like there might, you're behaving like an automaton with respect to something that matters. And if that happens, at least a yellow flag ought to go up that gets you and all of us to think about that context and that person in that context. And what is it about the engineered socially, the techno-social environment that they're in that's leading the person to behave in a manner that's machine-like with respect to this kind of thinking or this kind of relating or this kind of thing that we think is essential to human flourishing. That, so that's the idea behind the reverse Turing test.
Beautifully said. So we take our core humanity for granted. We're just like, yeah, that's what it means to be human. We go through life. We deal with different things. There are different advancements in different ways. I mean, we came through the Industrial Revolution. People came off the land. They went into cities, and then they lived on top of each other. And there are all sorts of implications about that, and yeah, all sorts of things. And there are many people who would say, oh my goodness, that's dehumanizing in different ways. But what we're bumping up against in this digital technological environment that is driven by algorithms and all sorts of forces that are hidden is perhaps for the first time challenging in our civilizational journey, challenging our core humanity. Right? Would you say that that's fair? And then, so that's why listeners, people, the rest of us at large should be concerned about the things that you were concerned about. Because this, for the first time, things that we took for granted that would always exist.
Yeah, I mean, I'll challenge myself. So I kind of agree with what you're saying, and it's kind of a pitch that we make. But I'll give you a critic's response to my own thing, what you're saying, but also in a way that will hopefully illustrate a broader point. I wouldn't say it's never happened before, because in certain contexts, in certain environments, we've definitely had situations in time where the techno-social conditions of the environment are such that people have very little autonomy or freedom to self-determine their lives, or had very little upside in terms of their ability to practice reason or to socialize with people outside of prescribed relationships. So there have been constraints throughout human history. We tend to think that today, in today's world, we have progressed not towards perfection or we're in some ideal state, but we've made lots of progress from where we may have been in the centuries past. And I think that is in a general sense true. But at the same time, we've built ubiquitous techno-social systems, right? Like that are increasingly interconnected and increasingly data-driven, incredibly powerful, and potentially personalized so that it can be individuated in terms of their the kind of stimuli that they're designed to engineer and then impact our responses, right? That they can reverse a lot of the progress that we've made over the past centuries. And at the same time, potentially lead it to where we, like an even larger portion of the population is enslaved or is in basically, not necessarily enslaved in the traditional sense, but is sort of engineered to behave like automatons with respect to large portions of what we might think matters in life. But it will be convenient, right? So one thing we say in the book, and then again, we're not there yet, folks, so don't think I'm saying this is the way that we currently live. But if you look to the future of what we call this thought experiment, the experience machine 2.0, sort of like an extended experience machine idea. But if you look to the not so distant future, right, the way to make the most people on the planet happy, like if the goal, we haven't really gotten into this yet, but the logic driving the development of most modern digital network technologies and supposedly smart technologies, that are increasingly interconnected and integrated all across every environment you find yourself in, is a logic of efficiency, productivity, and happiness. Like, optimize the design of systems to efficiently, you know, maximize efficiency and productivity, but also to sort of make people happy. But the way to make people happy efficiently, if you want to make billions of people incredibly happy at lowest cost, the way to do so is to engineer their preferences so they want very little. And then just give them a little bit more than that. In other words, if you're able to engineer what it is people want, then there's no reason to engineer their preferences to want very much. Because if they want a lot, then you've got to provide a lot, and it costs more to provide a lot, to put it as simply and crudely as we possibly can, right? So if you want to sort of make hundreds of millions or billions of people as happy as they can be at lowest cost efficiently, right? The idea would be the way to do that would be to engineer their preferences so they want very little. And, you know, so the more powerful the technologies that are capable of engineering preferences are to affecting what it is that people believe and what it is that people want, the more that this horrific dystopian future I'm describing is plausible. Now, I say it's horrific and dystopian, but there are plenty of people who would celebrate it as utopian. And as we mentioned in the book, like, for example, a well-renowned and very well-respected philosopher, Peter Singer from Princeton, remember, we quote this in the book at some point, but we're sitting down for dinner and at Princeton, we're sort of talking about this idea. And I remember asking, like, if you could engineer a world in which provided, you know, maximized happiness for everyone at lowest cost, along the lines of what I was, you know, by sort of engineering people's preferences to want very little, would you build this world? This is sort of the thought experiment near the end of the book. And he said, yes. As a utilitarian, as a person who, you know, like, there's so much suffering in this world. There's a reason behind this. I don't mean to be painting him as a bad character. Like, it's a well thought out. It's like, there is so much suffering in this world that if you could maximize the happiness so people lived happy lives, then democracy and free will might be worth sacrificing.
Yes, there is that whole lane of thought, I think, which is, it really sort of brings into play my thinking, the importance of Western thinking. And I know some people think Western is a dirty word now, but for some people, but Western thinking has some things embedded in it that are so necessary for the planet, for humanity, for human civilization, for human flourishing. There's those core values of autonomy, the right to determine our own future, the right to believe what we want to believe and let that not be controlled by external forces. Because whose business is it to tell anybody, first of all, determine what a person believes happiness is, and then say, not only am I going to determine what you believe happiness is, but then I'm going to give it to you. That journey, the human journey, is one of overcoming obstacles, of having desire, of having your own self-informed desire. That's so foundational to the soul's journey on this, in this life, in this world. Like, why would you even come here? That going on that real authentic hero's journey, that's what it means to be human, and that's what it means to overcome challenges and to grow and expand and to become more.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's, I mean, the there's a bunch of different directions that it reminds me of Pedro Domingos, who's like a very famous, one of the leading AI experts, written like the book on it. I forgot the name of the book, to be honest, but the AI book that they teach in a lot of the schools and stuff. And he wrote this article in Scientific American, like 2019, maybe it was. And it was sort of, basically kind of celebrating this, that one of these technologies, like the technology of sort of digital doubles, and the idea you're going to be able to run an AI that has sort of a digital double for you. And it was, you know, among other things, I don't want to oversimplify it. It's a complicated thing. There's more to his article than what I'm about to say. But the thing that resonated with me and with what you were just saying is he talked about the idea of like the digital double being, you know, it's going to solve some of these really tough problems in life, right? You know, so like, the digital double can like go on a bunch of different simulations. It could live 1,000 or 1,000,000 different potential lives for you, and go on 1,000,000 different dates. So like choosing what life plan or like what job to take or whatever. But also like, you know, who your romantic partner, like who you should, you know, who your mate should be. You know, this digital double could go on millions of dates and live millions of countless lives, simulated lives, and then come back to you and sort of find the right life and the right, you know, partner for you. And wouldn't that be wonderful? Because it would just, you know, you'd save you all the trouble and no zero transaction cost, da, da, da. So I wrote a letter to the editor to Scientific American that they published, I think in the January issue, 2019 or 2020 or something. And I can't remember, but it was, and it basically was like, but this is the weirdest thing. Like the, you know, what if, how do you know what it is you want? Like if actually you have any degree of contribution to your own preferences at all, right? Then like how, like you can't train an AI as a digital to go into a place because going on mediocre and bad dates is actually how you may need to do that as an experience to learn about what it is that you want. Like how do you form exactly your preferences without experiences of your own?
How do you get to yes if you don't go through you have to go through very often. It's the failure, it's the wrong, it's the bad that informs you about what you truly desire, what your heart's desire is. How do you even know what you want if you don't go on the journey?
It's not just some latent thing to be found by a program. It's something that is found through. It's not even like there's a true thing. It's just a thing that's found through the experiences that you happen to have. You don't have those experiences, right?
It's not an objective truth. It's a subjective, individuated learning and unfolding as you go through life. And nobody outside of you can tell you what that is. Because if they do, it's already wrong.
Right.
Because it is what you came. We all come here to figure out what we want. And we add value to the world by our unique ideas, desires, wants. And the journey to finding that is our journey. It is like the only thing worth having we're born. Like why even be born?
It's a social one. It's done with others, not with
and
other
it's a
digital
social
doubles.
One.
It's not done on your behalf by a program.
It's not done on your behalf.
Right. I do think for things like preferences and beliefs that of that sort, like it's just nonsensical to talk about digital doubles doing it for you. I mean, but it is a vision of the world that is driving the deployment and design and celebration and hype and investment and a bunch of different
100%. And this is the problem when we have, I remember back in the 2000s, I was observing Google's sort of power moves, and I mean, Google at its very core is an AI company, and its search engine was built around AI. The very core technology is always an AI company. It's fallen behind right now, but Google has always been an AI company. I'm thinking, who are these people? I could see what was going to happen. Why are they being given this room and this space to determine the future for so many people? Who are they? How are they equipped? I mean, that rhetorically to say they're not equipped to do this. And so we have technologists who are not trained to think about humanity as a whole and think on behalf of how do we create tools that actually support human flourishing.
So it's interesting too, because there's gradually been recognition that you can't just like you need interdisciplinarity, or you need more than just the technology to determine things. In the early days of Google, and I knew a lot of some of the folks at least that involved, like a lot of the folks were like, you know, well-intentioned designers of technology who were truly hoping to make the world's knowledge organizable and accessible to all. And while some of those folks would certainly recognize the constraints on their, you know, maybe ability to see the social and ethical implications of what they were doing, they were still well-intentioned. One of the stories, and it's not just Google, like a lot of the companies, one of the stories you'll see if you kind of study these industries a lot is sort of the role that, on one hand, engineers and technologists play, but also the role that the marketing and business folks have in sort of driving certain kinds of decisions. And sometimes there's conflicts over there. Kind of, I was just yesterday or the day before, talking with someone about the net neutrality, open internet debates, which is another, this comes up in the book, but it's also something I've written about in the earlier book and other things. And even at companies like Comcast or Verizon and stuff, there's often sort of differing opinions. Like the official company position is one thing, but like there's differing opinions among engineers versus like marketing and business folks versus the lawyer. Like a lot of different positions internally about like what the technology requires or what it ought to do or how it needs to do this or that. Right. And you see a lot of the conflicts among the different departments within companies sort of surfacing in what decisions they make about what to invest in and how to deploy and sort of where or where not to put safeguards and the kinds of safeguards that they build into the technology.
I want to talk about some specific things you bring up in the book. You talk about nudging, and we know what nudging is, but in the context of this, what is nudging and how does it play out and who's nudging whom?
Yeah. So nudging, like Cass Sunstein, Richard Thaler wrote this book called Nudge. I think it was in 2008, highly influential book in sort of public policy circles. It's sort of law and behavioral science. And, you know, again, it's very well-intentioned. The idea behind, and in some context, very positively, incredibly useful, but also in some ways overextended and, you know, applied in a variety of other contexts, which they would sort of quickly say that, well, that's not what we meant, or that's not what, that is the kinds of practices where people are using the exact techniques of nudging aren't really, it doesn't count as nudging because it doesn't satisfy certain sort of, you know, criteria that they might want to insist upon. But basically what nudging boils down to is, choice architecting, sort of architecting the range of choices that people have, informed by data about, often from behavioral psychology, behavioral economics, about the kinds of typical biases that tend to lead people astray, right? So people sort of don't behave in accordance with their own interest or their own preferences or rationally, according to which model you're sort of going to use. In a predictable fashion, and given that we can predict, and we've got studies sort of showing how people predictably deviate from their own interests or what's instrumentally rational, we can nudge them towards better outcomes for them if we structure their choices in certain ways. So in the kinds of ways you do that are by setting defaults or providing in a certain way, preset defaults or providing information in certain ways or other kinds of things. Like, or just like the ordering of food in a cafeteria is like one of those famous examples where they're like, well, if you put the healthy food first, people are much more likely to pick healthy food than if you put like the French fries and pizza at the front of the line, right? So there's like impacts about the ordering of food where people will sort of, predictably choose against their own interests because they sort of see what's in front of them, you know, things like that.
So our behavior in a technologically, in a digital technology world, we're online all the time on our mobiles, and our information is being shaped. We're on apps. We are on in various technologically constructed environments. Our behavior can be shaped based on how the design of that environment.
Yeah, I'll give you two easy examples that I often use that will resonate. Yeah. Like one is one that your listeners, I keep saying readers, that your listeners will like know off the top of their head, like, oh yeah, I did this yesterday. Another is one that they can run for their own, on their own, like as we're talking, right? So the first is just think about e-contracting. So you all click I agree repeatedly all the time, right? To form contracts. So e-contracting interfaces are designed in a way that it would be irrational to do anything other than click I agree and keep going, right? Now, if when you go to like rent a car or buy a house or take out a loan from the bank or dot, dot, dot. There's a variety of circumstances in which, like when you're entering into written contracts where you would want to stop and think about the terms and know about the price and sort of certain details, not everything. No one reads everything, but there's certain details you might want to know about before you just signed on the dotted line, right? You wouldn't sort of, if I gave you an envelope with a contract on the inside, but I sealed it and said, just sign the outside and you're bound by what's on the inside, you probably wouldn't sign it, right? Because you wouldn't trust that about what the terms might be. And yet in the digital world, all of us all the time just click I agree without ever knowing what's on, what the terms are, right? And that's sort of in the book, we talk at length about how you could design it differently, but it's basically designed to nudge you not to read or deliberate or think more, but just to click I agree, right? And that's through a practice that the way to see that in terms of design is it's frictionless in the direction of contracting, just click I agree. But it's frictionful, so there's asymmetric friction in the design of the interface. So there's frictionless in one direction, but it's frictionful in terms of actually thinking, deliberating, deciding whether to... So they nudges you to not go in one direction, but go in the other. Another example, so that's hopefully familiar. There's a whole chapter in the book about this, and I've written up, there's other things that you can find online.
Yeah, it's actually, you talk about electronic contracting and how websites are meticulously designed to engineer us into that swift click of the agree button, which it's a massively important reconfiguring of our behavior and pushing us into making agreements and legal agreements that we don't even know have any idea what it is. You know, Google just sent me an update this morning. Said, we are updating the terms of our agreement. If you continue to use the product, you will have agreed to those terms. What is happening to us? Like law was a thing in the 20th century. Like contract law was an actual thing. Like it was something. You couldn't actually sign a contract if you didn't have proper legal advice. It would not be enforceable.
The answer is don't worry about it. You're not really signing away your life. The market polices the terms. And if things were really that egregious, you could go to court and court find them unconscionable or wouldn't enforce certain really, like if you tried to sign away the first, the naming rights of your first kid, like it wouldn't actually be enforceable. So don't worry about it. You know, there's sort of that kind of market will police it. This is just an efficient way to sort of sort things out response, which sort of ignores, this is all in the book, and I've got another paper actually coming out shortly on this. It just ignores all kinds of hidden things. Like one, how it trains you to just click I agree, even outside the context of contracting. Two, it ignores like all the privacy destroying clauses that are in those contracts that you just get used to over time because no one ever challenges them. So those don't actually get challenged in court. So there's like this idea that like extremely egregiously terrible things would never get enforced. So you don't need to worry about the naming rights for your first baby clause. But in between like egregiously terrible, unreasonable things and like perfectly fine things are a bunch of unreasonable things that just become normalized over time. So like we've come to accept over the last 20 years that third parties who have no idea who they are, like tons of strangers, are in fact invited into your world by the service provider with whom you contract. And that's all enabled by the contracts you sign, but it's not challengeable.
Exactly.
And there's nothing you can really do about it right now, the way that the world is structured. The way that contract law and privacy law and a couple areas of law are structured, there's like very little you can do about it. But that's all because of the way that the integration of both law and architecture technology are woven to, this is why it's techno-social. It's not just techno and it's not just social. It's sort of the social institutions and the technology woven together. Basically, have engineered a world in which digital contracting is a joke. Right. It just isn't.
Right. And what that does is it tips the balance, not just tips, but it reconfigures the balance of power away from the individual to these massive tech companies who now can do whatever the heck they want. And we are not only have we been nudged and engineered into this in an overarching way, but if we dare challenge it, there's so many reasons why we're the bad guy. And then in the end, the fact is they have the deep pockets.
And stakes for most situations too. The stakes are so small, it's never worth it anyone's interest to challenge. So it's a typical collective action problem. So it's unilaterally imposed. So the companies, for all those who worry, like it's the market versus the government here too, by the way, I mean, this is a single act, like very powerful single actors who unilaterally govern millions of consumers through their terms in ways that
billions in some cases
challenge. And so they largely go unchallenged. So it's a weird governance.
So techno engineering is not just happening at the individual level. It's happening at a societal level. It's happening at a national level. It's happening at a global level. And the reconfiguring of humanity at a civilizational level is happening. And yet we're just sitting and watching it and like, oh, it's no big deal. Google can run the world. Microsoft can run the world. Facebook can run the world. Let's just give them the keys to the kingdom. All is well. But it's not. Who are these people? What positions them to be the shepherds of the future of all things? I mean, what qualifies them to have this power? Do they know how to use it? We've gone backward in from a democratic society or a society evolving toward more democratization to a society that's medievalized, where a few people, a few feudal overlords control everything, and yet we are pressured into, if you say anything, you're a bad person, you're anti-technology. No, I'm just anti-big tech.
Well, it's certainly a big consequence of these techno-social systems is that there's small little things that aggregate, like you said, with contracting is one example, there's other examples, but they concentrate power in smaller numbers of individuals. And the power is with private companies that are multinational and sort of expansive in their scope. And it's not like the powerful private companies aren't also at times contracting with and other words have other kinds of relationships with the public actors as well. So it is a complicated, as you said, it operates at the micro, at the meso, and at the macro levels. And in some ways, this is why I always kind of liken it to climate change. It's like one of those problems that is the problem is caused by many different things happening at many different scales. And the solutions, if you start to think about them, are things that you need to look at the micro, meso, and macro scales. You can't just solve it with one kind of panacea-like solution because it doesn't exist.
When you wrote the book Reengineering Humanity, it was came out 2018, right?
2018. Yeah. Well, that's when it came out. We wrote it between 2010 and 2018, so it was a long haul.
So that was pre the current LLM-driven sort of AI boom. Yeah. What are your thoughts since then on these large language models and their role now in this reengineering of humanity?
I think it's a continuation. So one of the stories that we tell in the book is one of, a frequent response to anything along the lines of what we're saying is, oh, this has always happened. You know, Luddites always complain. This is just another moral panic, just like every other media technology in the past. And so we spend some time in the book sort of explaining the trajectory that we're on. And the trajectory goes back quite a ways, right? I think in the opening you mentioned Taylorism. It starts it's at least as early as the late 19th century sort of movement to scientific management of human beings in the workplace, otherwise known as Taylorism, right? Data-driven management of what people are doing in their workplaces. And, you know, what's happened is that's extended outside the workplace, and the tools for both collecting the data and for managing people in those environments, not just the workplace, but in their homes, in schools, and everywhere in between, has just gotten more powerful, right? And so we walk you through that and then into radio and print and radio and TV, television, and then onto the digital network world of the internet, and then the social media and all the platform level, applications level examples of different interpersonal and mass media style platform level media companies. And what as you move through all those things, it's they're interconnected in the terms of the underlying logic of efficiency, productivity, and trying to maximize happiness. And they're also, what's changing is the what has changed or gotten sort of exacerbated or made things different in certain ways is the smartness or the AI or the data-drivenness, the way that the mass of everything that happens on the internet or digital network technologies involves the collection and use of data. There's always zeros and ones that are cheaply shareable and storable and processable. And they're used to generate different kinds of intelligence. And that's what makes things supposedly smart. Of course, the question is supposedly smart for whom? Who gains what intelligence? It's not always you that gets smarter. It's often someone else gaining the intelligence. And with the LLM sort of, LLMs have been around for a while, but the generative LLM sort of move is a, like sort of the latest generation or latest type of supposedly smart technology. And there's all the same questions we'd ask about other AIs still remain, like who gains what intelligence exactly? What kind of intelligence are we talking about? There's lots of constraints on the kinds of intelligence that LLMs can actually have, generative AI can actually have. It displaces some and, you know, replaces others and sort of reallocates power potentially in different ways. It also runs all the same risks that we talk about in reengineering humanity of outsourcing thinking of all kinds so that we don't develop our skills and we instead rely on technology to do certain things for us. And so, like, when I think of generative AI, there's a lot of different issues to think about, but in terms of the need for governance of LLM systems and their deployment in different contexts. But if you think about things like in schools, schools struggle to know what to do with, do we look at generative AI as just another one of many tools that kids can have access to and sort of they can learn to use effectively? I'm not an expert on ed policy with LLMs right now, but I tend to think that there's a lot to learn without an LLM that we're not teaching and that we can do better without digital tech at all, much less with LLM-driven tech in our elementary grade, middle and high schools. And certainly as we, maybe as we're getting into sort of the college levels, using LLMs is a, productive way to teach certain kinds of learning. But I don't have a terribly strong informed position on exactly what that should look like. But I think the set of questions are basic that it's raising are basically just continuations of the same. And again, the hype about generative AI and what it's capable of doing is so high that it makes it very hard to know what's a trustworthy source, who to take seriously when they're talking about both its capabilities, but also about the guardrails that people want to put up for it.
The negative side.
That's kind of where I am, I guess.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that interests me about it is the question of our human information, our collective body of information, what is fact and what is not, and the possibilities there for things to sort of go wrong. I mean, the base models are trained on all of the data available on the internet, but then they turn around and then create data, create new facts, create new kinds of content. And then that feeds into our collective. And so I think, we have to be very concerned about it. But I think I agree that the hype is, it's starting to look like the hype is, my perspective, there's a lot of hype. Maybe a good percentage of what we are getting is the hype of it, not the fact of it.
Like all of the things we've been talking about, there's interesting, applications and uses of it that, there are things that generative AI can do well that are useful. But what those things are, the actual use cases versus it could do this, it could do that, I think, remain to be seen. And again, it's very hard to separate fact from fiction.
You've done a ton of research in the area of shared goods, public goods, commons, internet commons, who owns the commons. What is this and why is it important?
Probably a third, if not a little more than a third of my sort of research is on something called knowledge commons. Although I do also just have an infrastructure commons, but the When you talk about the commons, in some conversations, people think of the commons as the thing, as a resource, as a thing that's out there. In my work, it tends not to be that. It tends to be that there are resources like knowledge itself or information or data, or it could be a park or a pasture, or it could be a transportation system, right? Those things are resources. What it means to talk about it as a commons is that it's shared and community governed. So there's a set of shared resources that are governed by a community. And that governance.
I'm so sorry. I think I want to just be clear. The reason I think it's an important part of this conversation is I think it's a necessary response to the overreach of the techno-social infrastructure. So the shared infrastructure as a response to the techno-social engineering that's happening with in the technology world. Anyway, just wanted to say that. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
go ahead.
And that's right. So focus in that area, like one way to see it is, so there's two ways in which I think I'm imagining you're thinking of this, or at least there's one of these two ways is probably what you're thinking, and I'll throw the other one in out there for the listeners too. So let me give you an example. Like, so one is the net neutrality debate. So in the book, we talk a lot about net neutrality, but we talk about neutrality style rules you might also need to apply on other supposedly smart systems, whether it be a smart home or a smart transportation network or a smart electricity grid. But the reasons are the same. And it has to do with the idea of a commons. So what net neutrality does, what an open internet rule does, is basically says the owners of the infrastructure, the ISPs themselves, can't discriminate based on who you are or what you're doing when they transport your packets. So when you're transporting your packets on the internet, your ISP really shouldn't, it shouldn't matter who's sending what to whom, and it shouldn't matter what it is you're saying. They're just zeros and ones, send the darn packets and let the people at the ends sort of resolve their transaction or their social interaction or whatever it is that they're doing. Let them determine how they use the basic infrastructure. This is kind of like on a road, right? When you use the roads, right, your transportation system, it doesn't matter if you're driving a BMW or a van. It doesn't matter, you know, who you are, where you're going, you have equal access. Like your use of the roads for the most part is non-discriminatory. It's not based on your identity, the identity of who you are or what you're doing. Same thing for net neutrality, basic idea for the internet, right? Digital network. And that kind of governance, that kind of managing the resource that we all as a community are accessing and using it on equal terms, is a way of one way of thinking about a commons. Right, is that the public at large is a community that's sharing the resource in a non-discriminatory way, and you might think that for one thing that does that rule that we don't discriminate, you don't let the infrastructure discriminate. They want to discriminate for a variety of reasons, but one of the primary reasons is so that they can extract more surplus, so that they can engage in things like price discrimination, so they can charge the person who's driving the BMW more because they're willing to and capable of paying more than the person driving a cheaper car. Or they can charge the person who's, you know, engaging in a video call more than they can for sending an email, right? You can charge more, you can price discriminate and therefore extract more out of the use of the platform if you can price discriminate or prioritize certain kinds of uses over others. And so a commons sort of prevents that exercise of power. And it's power that's a smart power, right? It's the way that the infrastructure owner would do it is by collecting intelligence, collecting data about what people are doing, and then charge them differently based on estimates, inferences about what they think they're willing to pay, right? So if we disable their ability to use that kind of intelligence, we can have a common shared infrastructure. So that's one way in which the commons sort of approach to thinking about commons can be useful in this smart tech world because it disables the use of intelligence to prioritize or extract money from people, more money from the system. The other way you might think about, I mean, there's also knowledge commons, like governing knowledge at higher layers, like that's another way knowledge commons can be relevant. And then the third way would be to think that a lot of the political economy of these techno-social systems, it leads you to think, well, it's about market. Like, let's rely on markets to sort of figure things out. Like, don't worry about the contracting problem. The market will sort out bad terms. Or it's the government's got to fix it. Like, we need the government to come in heavy-handed and determine everything. Reality is it's often some combination of governments and markets. But the other thing that's often ignored in that kind of conversation is the role of communities, like non-market, non-governmental actors, people who aren't for-profit market actors and aren't governmental political actors, but rather are community actors who want to work together to create shared infrastructures and shared spaces. That is a kind of commons arrangement that actually much of our world is built on, but we often don't appreciate and don't sort of leverage and don't support or even respect or give this same kind of respect that we ought to be giving it. And so that's another way you might think that the commons literature and commons sort of work could be useful in this area.
So how can we do that? How can we enhance and amplify and support and buttress this sort of community ownership and governance of the commons at all the different levels of the commons? Like the internet commons, there's just knowledge commons. If we have communities governing this and sharing that role, it's a far more equitable, far more effective, far more human way to do this, and far more supportive of human flourishing and the ongoing growth and evolution of our civilization. I mean, this is, I think, you're just proffering the answer to the big problem. So how can we build these communities?
It's a great question. I mean, it's a hard question. I don't have a perfect answer, to be honest. It's a really difficult question because you can't, we do like, you know, can we Wikipedia-ize the world? I mean, like, you know, Wikipedia works really well, but it doesn't work well for everything, right? So it works well in a certain sector in a certain way. It operates at sort of the content applications and content layers of the internet. And, you know, if we're thinking at the platform application level, and this is, there is a little bit of this in the book, actually, I hadn't thought about this, but now that you're making me think about it, I'm remembering, there is this thing like we propose like alternative institutions for things like social media, right? So I had once failed, by the way, this is a complete failure, it didn't go anywhere, but I had once proposed to the BBC that it create a social network for the UK. And people are going to think this is crazy, and maybe it was crazy, but it was more like to get them. The reason being was that the BBC at the time was well respected. It was financed not by revenue in a commercial actor sense, nor was it financed by going to the government and getting funds every year. Like, so it wasn't politically reliant on the government for funds. Every 10 years, because of its charter, it gets funding directly from users, which are basically UK, you know, I think it's 95%+ of the UK citizens. And so the funding mechanism, the institutional setup, and also the commitments that it had allowed it it could have created a social network for the UK and said, we will never surveil you. Or at least, you know, we will not sell your data to advertisers. There's no reason, because that's not our business. Like, we could credibly commit to not doing the surveillance capitalism move that you see on every other social media platform. And they could credibly commit to sort of, we have expertise so that we can actually have quality-based, you know, sorting, filtering, prioritizing, you know, ranking, feed construction. And they could have built something that could do that without running being optimized for profit or for thin forms of engagement like you see on every other platform, right? And this never went anywhere, and there are political economic reasons why, but the idea of community-based or alternatively funded community-based infrastructural systems in social media and other platforms would be interesting to, you know, to be, but it's very hard to build those things. It's very hard to sort of motivate them. It's hard to get people to switch off networks they're already on. And if you go further down,
It's
harder to go down further down the stack. So you want to go to the infrastructure layer. It's very hard to build those systems. Now, some people talk about, mesh networks, mesh wireless networks, and blockchain solutions, and other kinds of decentralized approaches. And I think there's some promise in some of those kinds of decentralized approaches to building community systems that work and community platforms. But thus far, it's hard to scale in a way that would be truly competitive with the giants.
And I've been thinking a lot about that, and I think I know why. Do you want to hear?
Tell me.
So I think that a big part of techno-social engineering is algorithms, and algorithms designed to enrage, outrage, dig into our core sense of identity, and manipulate us from the inside. So TikTok, there was, you know, all the other platforms, and then TikTok emerged on the scene in 2018, I believe, and they had a For You algorithm. So the For You algorithm was, the other platforms didn't have it, and TikTok immediately blew up, and people were like, whoa, what's going on here? And then they said, oh, it's this For You algorithm. Then all the other platforms crafted a For You algorithm, the latest of which was Twitter X. I spent a lot of time on Twitter. That's where I built my sort of base, and I saw things shift in front of my eyes. The For You algorithm is this very dangerous thing. It works two ways. It engages the user and it hooks them and it says, oh, we're going to trigger them. We're going to outrage them. We're going to make them do what we want them to do. Does it? And it wins. This is why TikTok is massive. Does that better than everybody else. And then if the influencers, huge players in this, if they don't play that game of what the platform wants, and if they don't create the content that the platform that aligns with the algorithmic drive, then they're bumped off and they're screwed. So they then become the humanizers and the enforcers of the algorithm. And that's, so the influencers benefit from the algorithm if they play the game. The users are hooked because they're like, this is the purpose of my life. I must fight this cause. I must do this. That person is evil. That's the villain. We must kill. Attack. So they get up each day, and now this is the core purpose of their life because the content is connected to their identity. So you try to build an alternative social network that's actually good, that's based on governance, that's collective and distributed maybe, and is actually good for humans. You're not going to compete because this machine over here is powerful and it is sort of feasting on everything we know about the human psyche. It's a very, very ugly thing. That's what's happening.
Incredibly highly personalized. Probably the best, yes. Best in a good sense. It is the most powerful personalization, yes, of a content in your feed that leads to the incredibly, yes, superficial engagement. And it's not even designed to do engagement other than superficial engagement. It's just
so that's what's happening. So how do we compete with that? I don't think we can. I think that in and of itself, that algorithmically driven content designed to take a hold of you from the inside and remove your any idea of autonomy or free will, if that has to go, that in and of itself is a bad thing, and we need to remove it from society because literally no good comes of it. All it does is whoever owns that operation.
So the hardest thing about figuring out how, like, I mean, and TikTok is, you know, it may very well be that in a year and 6 months and 2 years that there'll be something worse, right? Like it or a different version or something that lasts longer, that lasts shorter, that does it differently. That's more direct.
They'll just be an American.
The point is, it's very hard to get at so one of the things that I've been working on lately a lot, I just did an NSF grant, like who knows where it'll go anywhere, but I've been working on an NSF grant on projects that are along these lines, is on friction. It's called friction in design and friction in design regulation. There's a paper with Susan Benesch in the Yale Journal of Law and Technology like a year ago. Maybe 2 years ago on this, but the idea is the way to, I mean, it's not the only way, but one possible way to sort of start making some changes. This doesn't go in the commons direction exactly, but it goes in a different direction, is to try to inject friction in the regulation, in the design of these things. So, you know, in the friction may be in the form of timeouts. It may be in the form of, there's only so much time. So in other words, sort of like preventing infinite scrolling. You've got to have finite scrolling, and the finite scrolling, what the rules are about finite scrolling might have to vary based on content, or not content, based on the kind of application that you're running. There may be other kinds of things like private, better privacy laws might have more of an impact on how personalized things could be. It's very hard to compete if what you're competing with is the most addictive and personalized and powerful platform to just straight up try to outcompete it with an alternative design.
It's going to be hard. In your research and in work in general, this is a question I like to ask everybody. What surprised or surprises you?
That's a great, and again, that's a good question. I don't know. I think what one thing that surprises me, I guess, is how little people work across disciplines. Like I know it's trendy, and like for the last 20 years, it's like everyone's been saying like interdisciplinarity, that's the way to go, and things should be multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary. But like it's really hard to do, I guess. But it just seems like it's what everyone should be doing, and for some reason, it's still like it's constantly an uphill battle, and it's just surprising to me. And there are little things like that. Like there's little things like. You just think that would be the norm instead of being exceptional at this day and age. That's probably not what you meant, Bob, when you're thinking about like what's surprising.
No, that's fine.
Surprising.
That's a fair. That's fair. You're not very surprised by stuff. okay, I want to have another question.
Surprise is the disconnect between academic and academic work and practice. Like you'd think that would be more integrated, but there's this sort of thing, it seems like it's just a gap that exists that's hard to bridge.
If you could design a future path for humanity, you're looking at multiple disciplines and you're seeing very unique perspective, and I think it's very useful. You had carte blanche to design the trajectory next 15 years. What would you do? And you could do anything. You had the power to do anything. What first three things you do?
It's funny that you asked that also, because like I think more, I guess in more practical terms, not in terms of what would I do with carte blanche. I mean, I might, so like more practically to me, it's sort of, trying really hard to figure out how to slow things down so that people actually, reconsider what matters and in life and in their smaller groups. And, I don't pine for like the days of what life was like when I was growing up. So a lot of you get this like old timer effect where like you're an old timer and you just sort of are pining for the days when things were better when, you were younger. But in fact, that's what every old timer says, sort of another version of the, those other arguments you were talking about earlier, but it's not that exactly. There's features of the world that as it existed 20 years ago, that it would be nice to have respected and to reintegrate into the world of the next 20 years. I wish if I could slow things down a little bit, change the sort of the speed at which people want things delivered, help people to recognize that convenience is overrated, recognize that sometimes inefficiencies are actually socially beneficial. Just like you want to go on some bad dates and mediocre dates, in order to form your own preferences and find good people to relate to, for the same reasons you sometimes want to have bad media experiences, not like, you know, always and over, but, you know, it's not about, you know, immediate satisfactions and satiation. There's a value, you know, I think the thing that the 21st century constitutional lowercase c constitutional question is, you know, there are freedom to be off, like our freedom to not be subject to the influence of others, especially the influence of others who are absolute strangers. Like it's fine to be influenced by people who are, close ties and even like, you know, moderately close weak ties, but the people who you actually know, there's a certain degree of influence they should have on how you think and who you believe, because that's how we socialize. But the degree to which we live our lives influenced by absolute strangers is too much, I think. And I feel like that's something I would love to see dialed back quite a bit. There's other things like a commitment to like, just because things have gone in a direction, like this sort of techno-determinist kind of ideas, doesn't mean that it's inevitable or good. And there's a million examples of this, but like one of the ones I sometimes talk with my kids about is like reading, like, you know, the idea that like the amount of the numbers of people who read for pleasure, things that take more than 10 minutes, an hour to read. You know, I don't know the study, so maybe I'm totally wrong empirically, but my anecdotal experience with every single person I know and every single person I interact with in a variety of different contexts is that our ability to commit to any kind of sustained thing that requires sustained attention is significantly challenged. And so just, you know, there's a value to reading books that is just under, and this is not just a Luddite and it's not a pining for the past. It's that there's actual social value from able to actually reading and imagining and empathizing with characters in a book that is in fact different from what you do watching videos or playing video games, both of which are things I do, by the way, with my kids and on my own. But nonetheless, you know, it's sort of finding that kind of balance, I think, that, you know, seems to sometimes be missing. Those are just some. I mean, I could go on and on about this stuff, but.
No, that's good. That's good. What's one thing that listeners can do to become more ready for the future? Because you just had a bunch of things, but if you had to pick one thing, or maybe one thing you tell your kids, like you're a dad. How old are your kids?
Oh, I've got a 15, 17, and 23-year-old. All
perfect. Students. High school, college, like just getting ready for the world. I mean, this is like the most pivotal time. What do you tell them?
You know, be other regarding, like care about the welfare of others besides yourself. Try to find work that you actually like doing in life. Doesn't mean, but then at the same time, recognize that you often have to do things you don't like at work in order to have the freedom or the opportunity to do the things you do like. And the question is like how much of a balance that is in the things that you do. Take risks, you know, challenge yourself and all that. Like those are the kind of the basic sort of things. With the tech stuff, it's all about balance. Like we were talking about somebody with this, I was at an addictive design technology conference last week and someone was asking about parenting stuff. And I was like, you know, they're like, oh, well, you know, what do you set the parental controls on your kids for? And I was like, well, the first thing is like, I didn't give my kids phones until they were freshmen in high school. But by the time they did, I didn't set the parental controls. I don't set the parental controls on my kids' phones. And they're like, what do you mean? How can you do that? All this thing you're talking about, like, aren't you worried about this and that? So the parental controls are in their heads. Like they exercise their own controls. Like they think for themselves because we've talked about this stuff enough and they've heard, you know, granted they've heard it from me enough, but they disagree with me on some things too. But like, you know, I like my freshman, he has TikTok on his phone. He watches TikTok some. He also talks about some of the ridiculous things he sees and, you know, tries to get off it. And his older brother tells him, dude, you're on TikTok too much. Turn it off. Like, so there's, you know, for me, it's, you know, I talk to them a lot like they're real people so that they can think for themselves. So I don't have to exercise that kind of control. But, you know, I don't know.
That's good. Talk to each other like we're real people. That's one thing
there you go. I don't know what my pithy advice lines are. I don't usually, you ask good questions. I didn't really think about it. And then on the fly, I'm like, I'm not very good on the fly.
No, I love it. It's real. Okay. So Brett, what's next for you? What are you working on?
Yeah, I've got a bunch of projects all on friction and design. So one on contract, you know, reforming digital contracting, another one on something called governance seams. So it's like friction at interfaces that enable governance. And so one of them is on sort of privacy sensitive age gating. So whether in fact you can design, and then what are the trade-offs of designing technologies that would verify age in order to set up defaults. Less, I'm not as interested in policing content, although I think it's important, but I mean, in the sense that I care about bad content infecting people, but I'm not concerned about like age gating for content. I'm more concerned about age gating to set, to sort of ban bad designs like infinite scrolling, or to, you know, set privacy protective defaults, for example. Or contracts, another example, it's interesting. Like we were talking earlier about contracting, like, you know, miners' behavior every single day is to enter into contracts, right? They click, I agree, like all the rest of us, routinely creating millions and millions of contracts every day. And yet in most states in the United States, in the US at least, those contracts are all disaffirmable. Like they're not enforceable.
Right.
And yet we nonetheless, they perform the actions and they learn as if that's okay, and they behave as if that's okay, which I think is just crazy. So like the age verification, like privacy sensitive age gating might be to sort of police contracting behavior, for example. So that's a project. And then I'm the PI on a big NSF grant that deals with knowledge commons. So I sort of am managing some of that stuff.
What is that? I'm very curious about it.
Yeah, so governing knowledge commons is, so for like 15, 20 years or so, we've been studying this with other people. It's an interdisciplinary research project where we study how groups or communities collectively sort of govern the curation, sharing of different knowledge resources. And the knowledge is data, patents, copyrights, all kinds of products of human intellect. So Wikipedia is an example. And a lot of it's case study-based research. And so there's a whole book series we have a Cambridge book series on knowledge commons and medical research commons. And we've got one on ed tech conference and a book coming up pretty soon. We had a misinformation knowledge commons book that the conference last year, but there's going to be a book coming out soon, next couple months, I think. And so I've kind of helped lead some of those kinds of projects too.
And if those things pan out the way you hope, how does that add value to the world? I mean, for people who have no idea what you're talking about, yeah, why should they care?
The way to see it is, so Eleanor Ostrom she passed away, but she was the first woman to get the Nobel Prize in economics. And what she got the Nobel Prize in economics for was work in similar interdisciplinary work studying the commons, but natural resource commons. It was basically how do communities sustainably govern shared natural resource systems, an irrigation system, a pasture, et cetera, forest land. And what that did was to help people to figure out how to design solutions, how to create communities that could actually work together to solve shared problems in environmental. Our work is trying to do the same thing. So we have an evidence-based way to inform the design of institutions and communities so that people know how to, like, what works and what might not work, or what are the kinds of things you want to design into your community governance or a set of rules about who gets to be members and who does what and dispute resolution and things like that when you're dealing with shared knowledge resources. So that's the goal of the overall agenda, where there's a number of people. And like we're at the stage now where we're building, well, we've got a series of books and lots of case studies and lots of research, but we're also sort of building the community itself. So it's kind of an emerging field, essentially, which is kind of nice.
That's exciting. Okay. Anything I should have asked that I didn't ask? Anything else you would like to say as we wrap up?
No, I think not that I can think of. I think we covered a lot, maybe more than we anticipated. And so feel free to cut whatever if I was rambling or
making. Oh, no, I don't know. I think, you know, what I've learned as I'm doing these podcasts is I'm not just going to give people great information and let them, you know, take what they take from it. And that's really powerful. I love everything you talked about. I think the work's so important and pivotal for betterment or building, evolving this whole thing in the right direction. And I really, I mean, thank you for what you're doing. We need it. This is so crucial.
Thanks. It just might be in a link or something at the description of the talk or whatever, but you can also say it if you wanted to, but you might like, there's a TEDx talk that I gave a few years ago that like no one has seen.
What was the topic?
It's on the exact same thing. But I cover some examples we didn't talk about. Like, so it talks about the Facebook happy birthday experiment and some other things. So like, it might just be an interesting, like for people who want to see more or whatever, that the TEDx talk might be useful.
And do you have a newsletter that listeners can sign up
no,
for?
No, I don't do okay. a newsletter.
All right. So I will put all of your links in the description, including the book and the articles that you've written, the many books and the articles and the TEDx talk and you have a website.
I do, but the website's terrible. Like I have
Yeah, it is. It is terrible. The bio is just like not updated.
My websites are terrible. I know it is. I have a Villanova website, which is terrible. I have my brettfrischman.com website, which my brother created like years ago, and it's terrible.
Oh yeah, that's the one I saw. Yeah, no, it's fine. It's just not updated, and it should be updated.
Yeah, I'm so lazy about that.
No, don't say that. It's just you're busy doing big things for humanity. Find somebody to do it for you. Oh, you have kids. Let one of the smart. You have smart kids. Let them help. Brett, this was awesome. Thank you so much for coming.
That was nice
on.
To meet you. It was great. A lot of fun. Thanks for having me. It's pretty cool.
Make sure to listen, follow, and subscribe for new episodes wherever you get your podcasts and on our YouTube channel.